that's one of the things about religion that we have to remember when we're talking about that makes it such a hot topic issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy, like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Hive Mind. This is the second part of a 3-hour show, which was recorded February 22nd, 2021. I am your host, Nate Kapp, joined by co-host Brandon Martin. Welcome to the 41st Cubbyhole Podcast, where important topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. Our website is cubbyhole.com. That's CubbyWhole.com. As of now, this show comes out every Friday at 12 p.m. Pacific time, and please make sure to start at podcast number one if this is your first time hearing this show. There will be slides for today's show, so please make sure to go to the podcast part of the Cubbyhole website under episode 41 to follow along. And as I said, this is a continuation of the last show where we talked about the science of symbolism, the subversive use of symbolism, especially the subversive use of stellar symbolism. In the second part, we go further into the subversive use of stellar symbolism, including bear symbolism, the all-seeing eye, the axe, and the facies symbolism. And towards the end of the show, we introduce Freemasonry, what it is and what it is not. So I'm going to start right where we left off, and sorry if I sound a little winded, especially in the beginning of this episode. I've definitely been a little, you know, worn down from life lately, so, you know, it is what it is, but it's an awesome show, so you'll be glad you made it all the way through, and we're gonna go ahead and start right here.
Cool.
Okay, we are back, and Brandon is on fire with the mythos and subversive symbolism. I mean, it's just incredible the work that you've been putting out lately, and I felt like you did a very well, you did a very great job explaining all that about the stellar subversive symbolism. And you know, I know that you could go on and on a lot more, but you know, it's a vast topic, and I think you did a pretty fantastic job. I know you're going to explain more, but you're doing great so far. So,
well, thank you for that. It's definitely a hard topic to cover.
For sure,
it takes many years of research, and I mean, it's multiple lifetimes of research, honestly. But yeah, I'll continue on here. And this ties in with the last symbol, the symbol of the gavel. The next slide, we have the bear. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because the symbol of the gavel ties in with Ursa Minor, which is the little bear. And that's why we named this show The Cubbyhole, because it has to do with the little bear and all of the knowledge that the ancients had, especially the stellar cult. They preserved it and venerated it into the northern polar constellations and the seven pole stars of Ursa Minor. So I thought it would be crucial to bring up that the bear is also symbolic of the gavel. And I have a very, very good image of a bear on the slide, and I just love the way this bear looks. It almost looks like his head is a heart, and I feel like it's symbolic of true care. So the meaning and interpretation, simply, of bear symbolism is strength, endurance, power, spiritualism, kingship, peace, freedom, harmony, gnosis, perseverance, courage, care, and willpower. And I'm sure we can all see why these things are associated with bears, because of on grounds of likeness of how they behave. They're very strong. They have lots and lots of endurance. They have power, you know, but this is also about spiritual power. The reason why it's tied in with spiritualism, that mythology that I was explaining earlier on. So yeah, there's a lot to that when it comes to spiritualism.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Also, you know, on the grounds of likeness, when a cub is able to climb the tree, you know, the spirit, it's spiritually mirrored as the bear climbing up to the top of the tree of knowledge, the tree of life. And the bear is rising up the tree, and the bear is, you know, and the bear is, you think about the word to bear something is to hold something. So to bear the spirit.
That's right. So. To bear the knowledge as well, you know, right. To hold the right. knowledge. And I find it interesting that the bear comes out of a cave from hibernation. And that cave ties in with Plato's allegory of the cave, coming out of darkness into light. But it's also a cave is also a place of sanctuary. It's a place of security where you can grow and learn from at a certain level if you use it properly, because that's where the hermits would go to learn, you know. That's where a lot of the ancient shamans go to, you know, breathe in the entheogenic compounds to, you know, induce higher states of consciousness. There's these stories where they would put their seers, the children who were supposedly going to be the seers, in caves for 7 years, which I found very interesting. So that, you know, the seers were the people who could see into the spiritual realm. So that darkness is associated with that spiritual realm, and they were trying to train them to be able to see more clearly by putting them into those caves for that long. So it was a rite of initiation into the spirit knowledge. So the bear is tied in with kingship. That's also because it's tied up with the highest of high. And we find that there is a great allegorical reference in the movie The Golden Compass, where the bear, the northern polar bear, is associated with kingship. And he has to reclaim his throne by proceeding on a journey to the north with his companion, the sacred feminine principle who carries the moral compass, the compass that guides the way, which is Freemasonic. And it also has a lot to do with symbolic literacy, to lead him back to his kingdom and for him to raise upright into his proper place of kingship. So I would highly recommend watching that film to get an idea of some of the symbolic meaning behind the bear, especially the polar bear. The idea of the bear correlating to kingship also has a very ubiquitous nature with the Arthurian legend. Now, I'm not going to completely cover the Arthurian legend here, but I just want to give a little bit of etymological breakdown of the word Arthur, which literally means the bear. So Uth or Arth is a title that was given to those who had raised their consciousness into a high point of being, especially in the mystery traditions. So we have Uth or Arth, which means the bear, and this ties up with the entire hero mythos that we've been speaking about. And when it comes to the hero mythos, we do have to recognize that the king and the land are directly related to each other. If the king gets sick, then the land gets sick, which then gives the hero the call to his journey or to his quest, where he has to seek out one of the sacred items, such as the Holy Grail, to bring fertility back to the land or the king. That way, the land can become healthy again. There's many different versions of this story, so like I said, I'm not going to get into all the details of this, but it is crucial to understand that the Arthurian legend is solar currently currently, but the Knights of the Round Table, which is the circle dot, definitely has to do with the stellar cult. So it is a solar cult overlap in my point of view, or it's a means of preserving the stellar cult symbolism and the mystery traditions through the solar cult by bringing it down into the Arthurian legend. And I highly recommend that people study the Arthurian legend because it is one of the most important mythologies that we do need to have in our arsenal to further understand how the mythos evolves. So there's a lot to that when it comes to kingship. But yeah, the bear is symbolic of kingship, of being your own king, you know, being your own monarch, not being a ruler of others. Internal monarchy is how I would explain that. But it's also about peace. It's about tranquility, because bears can be very peaceful if you watch them in their natural habitat. They're extremely cohesive and in harmony with where they are living at. And, take Winnie the Pooh, for example. The bear there, he's a very peaceful bear, you know, just go lucky. And there's the cartoon The Little Bear. Obviously, there's all kinds of uses of this bear symbolism in cartoons specifically, which I find very interesting. And then it also ties in with the honey with Winnie the Pooh. Obviously, there's a lot to the honey symbolism, and maybe we can break that down in the future. I know you've talked on it a little bit, especially since we have the honeycomb as our background.
Bears love the honey,
right? No doubt. And that ties in with the symbolism of the sun as well. But it also represents freedom and sovereignty, you know. It represents freedom because the gavel represents true spiritual freedom, and so the bear represents true spiritual freedom as well. And like I said, it represents harmony, being in harmony with nature. It represents gnosis because it gets tied in with the ancient knowledge, the true experience of coming into the light of that knowledge that we need, coming into the light of truth and love and the one great spirit's will, if you want to look at it that way. Bears are, you know, persistent with whatever they do, with their endurance, but they persevere no matter what. So this is about their strength. And that's why I chose to put perseverance on there. They are, you know, they will never give up. And this is something that goes along with that idea of eternity, never changing, you know, never backing down, never giving up. So this also ties in with the next example and symbolic association to courage, you know, because bears are always symbolic of courage. There are many animals that overlap with all these, obviously, but, you know, I find it very, very important when it comes to the spiritual meaning behind all the animal and zoo-type psychological associations. But the bear is correlated to care as well, because we have to have our true care to understand these things. And we have to have the true care to dive deep enough into understanding our origins and understanding symbolism and understanding the nature of ourselves and the realm we're existing in, so that we can create real change, which ties in with will, because it has to do with willpower, the power to push forward, you know, the power to create change, creation. So that all ties in with the double-headed axe symbolism that I was just talking about. So I'm going to give you a couple examples of the bear here.
It's interesting that you said what you were talking about with the cartoons, because I was, immediately when you were saying care, I was thinking of the Care Bears, and they have the symbols on their bellies.
Right. That's funny. I meant to mention that, actually, the Care Bear cartoon. There's a lot of symbolism in the Care Bears. And, you know, like his head is looked like, or the symbol I chose, the bear looks like a heart. So I found that.
And they're always in the clouds.
Yep. They're always in the clouds, and they're always in the sky. So I do find that very, very profound, that symbolism there. I've always thought about that. And it's a great, great cartoon too. It has a very good moral principle into that. So
it's true.
When it comes to the double-headed axe and the bear symbolism, it also ties in with natural law, This has a lot to do with the laws of nature, because that's what we're studying. And this is one place that we preserved those laws and those sciences, was within the symbol of Ursa Minor and the symbol of the double-headed axe. So the subversive uses of this, and I have three examples of this. And, you know, people might have contention with two examples that I give here. But I do think that it's subversive and being used in a negative way. The first example is something I spoke upon in the Cult of Bill section, which is in the market. We do have the bull market and the bear market. The bull market represents an ascension of materialism and monetary wealth. And the bear market represents the, you know, the decrease of monetary wealth, but it's also the decrease of spiritualism when it goes down. So if the bear comes up, then we have a decrease on the other side, which is materialism. And what we really need is a balance between both spiritual and material, obviously, because we are spirits in the flesh. But if you go and look at the image, you see the bear and the bull standing off against each other. And this is the battle between the solar and the stellar cult. And currently, the solar cult is reigning dominion over this world. You know, it is absolutely controlling almost every aspect of this world. So it is definitely a subversive use of the bear and the gavel symbolism, because all things seven are the little bear. And that ties in with the seven pole stars, and that ties in with spiritualism. So, you know, I just wanted to throw that in there. The other two examples is the Chicago Cubs, you know, so I have an example of sports teams here using this symbolism, and it has a big C with the bear in the middle of that C, so that kind of symbolically to me looks like see the bear, you know, like see the highest of the high, as in S-E-E-C. So I find that pretty interesting. With that, but you have a cub, and the sea also kind of looks like a cubby, you know, it looks like a place that the bear might, you know, reside, or the knowledge might reside. And it's the little bear, because it's a cub, obviously. And then you have the Chicago Bears, which is a big bear, which definitely ties in with Ursa Major more so than Ursa Minor. So, you know, it's very important to distinguish those, but I do feel that it's important to put this in here because we're talking about both of these teams here. And this bear just looks absolutely vicious. It also has the sea with the bear coming out of the sea, like he's coming out to raise some hell, you know, he's coming out to tear some people up. So I feel that there's a lot of symbolism being portrayed here with these teams. And we find this in a lot of sports, obviously, where they're using associative magic symbols to influence people with this knowledge. So another thing I want to point out, and the main reason why I brought up these two sports teams, is because they are in the north. They are in the northern part of the country, which correlates to that idea of the northern pole star and the northern polar constellations. And they're also in the center. They are somewhat in the middle of the country, being This ties in with the middle pillar and also that middle path. So these are two other symbolic associations to these two teams. And this is not a coincidence that they are in the north, they are in the center, and they are bears, the big bear and the little bear, Ursa Minor and Ursa Major. So Nate, do you have anything you would like to add onto that bear symbolism? Because I know you're pretty well versed in that as well.
Well, I mean, you've pretty much said everything. I mean, not everything, but you know, you said everything I was thinking of. I just know that, you know, bear symbolism is an unfoldment for a long time, because, you know, when you understand especially the little bear as the Little Dipper or Ursa Minor, then you're getting into understanding that it is Polaris. And you think about, the bear does not have a tail, but when you look at the constellation of the little bear, you see you know, the tail is connected to the perceived fixed star Polaris. And what I take from that is because Polaris is the most high, because the little bear is the most high, I look at it as the bear with no tail as a tall tale that is told as a allegory. It's symbolic to help us understand that, you know, this is a tall tale that has to be told for us to find the truth that is held within this symbol, within this constellation. And this is, in my opinion, it is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, tale that's ever been told, because to try to get as close as you can to the Most High or to Source is a lifelong journey, if not multiple lifetimes.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you brought the tale up. I do find that very interesting, like you said, that bears don't tend to have long tails. And what you have found through green language and through the law of correspondence and synchronicity there, I feel is dead on. You know, I feel that is exactly what that is about at a certain level. I also know that, you know, Africa doesn't have bears, you know, so most likely this symbol was the symbol of the jackal at one point in the Egyptian mythos. So there's an association between the African gray wolf, the jackal, and the bear. And I feel that maybe the zoo type symbols got mixed up and eventually evolved, you know, after we had started to put different distinguishing characteristics of species as we moved out of Africa and as we exodused out of Africa. So the bear symbolism was not necessarily the first zoo type that was used to venerate the northern polar constellation, which is very important to understand. But I do feel that before that, it was the jackal. And I find that very interesting because it's always said that dogs are man's best friends. So there's some idea there that this knowledge is man's best friend as well, you know, that this is how we befriend God as well. You know, like there's a very symbolic association there with that. And I feel that one thing, this is my contention as well, the reason why dogs were considered to be man's best friend is because I believe that the first animal that ever came from nature to welcome the human race into nature's existence, to actually live with the tribe, was the African gray wolf. And we see a lot of symbolism with jackal, and the jackal gets associated with the spirit realm, just like the bear does in the Egyptian mythology, specifically in the solar mythology, later on when he's anthropomorphized as Anubis, and he becomes the spirit guide, the one who walks you through the Duat, or walks you through the spirit realm. And he's often seen depicted with Ma'at, the great judge, the great architect of the universe, the you know, which could be looked at also as the gavel in associative thinking. So there's a lot to that, and I hope to open up the jackal stuff in the future, because Jack means the sun, and then El means God as well. So there is some solar stuff going on with that at some level, but. Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting as well. But I don't think the Egyptians called it a jackal. Obviously, that's a later terminology. So, there's a lot to the jackal and the bear and the long tail, because dogs have long tails. And they even say that there was a species of dog bear at one point, and there was a possibility that there could have been a dog bear that existed that in Africa at one point. Now, my research hasn't turned up enough evidence of that. You can hear my dog in the background sneezing now. He must have caught a whiff of something. Oh, Hermes. But yeah, the dog bear was pretty interesting when I did research into that. But I haven't found an extreme amount of evidence to say that these stellar people existed around the same time that the dog bear existed, or the canine bear, you know, because they weren't called dogs, they weren't domesticated. But you get my point with that.
Yeah, it's really interesting to find. Like, I found a photo of a bear that was shaved, and it looked just like a dog.
Oh, right. And yeah.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, it's very complicated, all this stuff. And we're talking about very heady topics here that take a long time to really understand. So I'm just hoping to whet people's appetites with this. And, you know, I want to continue on and move through the next symbol here, which is the all-seeing eye symbol of the stellar mythos, which is so important to understand. And these all three connect to each other: the bear, the double-headed axe or the gavel, and the all-seeing eye. So if you move to the next slide with us, I have the all-seeing eye, which I have put in ultraviolet, or, you know, like a purple color, to represent the crown chakra as well, even though that usually the all-seeing eye is symbolic of the third eye chakra. I'm putting it on the crown color because this is about the all-seeing eye of the divine, not the individual, because we are seeking to become as close to the one great spirit as possible, but not to be it in its place. So our all-seeing eye is our third eye, which is lower, you know, than the crown, but the all-seeing eye of the universe would be the crown, in my point of view. That's my point of view on that. That's my opinion on that. So the meaning and interpretation of the all-seeing eye represents God, the creator, divinity, source, light, knowledge, truth, intelligence, sovereignty, and enlightenment. And, you know, I'm sure most people that listen to this episode have some knowledge about the all-seeing eye. But the reason why I bring this up here is because we find that the all-seeing eye is normally associated with the sun. The origins of the all-seeing eye far predate that of the solar cult mythology, where we see the eye associated to the movements of the sun. Now, it is true that the eye is still associated within the solar cult to a certain degree, because it does give us light or sight, things that allow us to see. It brings in the sight in the material world. But in the stellar, the grand all-seeing eye, or the one true all-seeing eye is what I should term it as, is the eye that sees both the material and the spiritual. And it is very important to understand when it comes to this. So the stellar cult first venerated into the southern polar constellations with the Zhu type, the jackal. This was known as Set, who was the first primary deity of the stellar cult. From the perspective of the Nile Valley, the ancient Chaldeans could see the northern and southern polar constellations, which were seen as the two great eyes of God, or of the one great architect. As they exodused out of Africa, the southern polar constellation, that of Set, fell below the line of the horizon. As this happened, they proceeded to see Horus, the northern polar constellation, rise into the heavens as the one great deity, or the ruler of reality, which I even have issues terming that the ruler. So we probably shouldn't even use that word there. But they seen and venerated this as the one grand architect of the universe. This is the origin story of Set versus Horus, before it was venerated into the eastern equinox and the autumnal equinox progression of the sun, where Horus is seen on the eastern horizon, who battles Set on the western horizon. Before we started to put a finer point on the celestial movements and a finer point on time, we had the association of the north and the south, of life and death, up and down. The north was associated to the material realm, whereas the south was associated with the spiritual realm. The south was associated to the spiritual realm because it is the unseen aspects of reality. So this corresponds to the night sky as well, because the night sky was associated to the spiritual realm. But it is when the realm of the spirit is visible to us here in the material realm. So it becomes physically visible to us. But before that, anything that was unseen, where, let's say, the sun travels underneath the planet, to them, they would think that the sun was dipping down below the planet or below Terra. They would consider that to be the journey into the Duat, or the journey into the spirit realm. This correlates to why the northern polar constellation gets tied up with the idea of materialism, even though it is in the night sky, or why Horus gets correlated to materialism, especially when he is transferred over to the mythology of the solar cult, where Horus becomes the sun in the day sky, whereas Set has to do with the spiritual realm. And this ties directly into the jackal mythology, with the anthropomorphic figure of Anubis, who is the spirit guide through the Duat. So when that southern pole star sank below the horizon and the north star rose above into the highest point, it became seen as the one eye of the great universal architect or God. One of the main reasons why this was so relevant to the ancients' minds is because all things in the night sky circled around this center point. This also correlates to that circle dot mythology in the stellar mythos. But the single point was the all-seeing eye, or the grand architect of the universe, seen as omniscient and omnipresent, all-knowing and ever-present in all places. So it was looked at as the divine creative principle. Now, it is important to note that it was not considered a deity, even though I may use that word here sometimes, because deity or deity has to do with the day sky. So it is important to distinguish those two things. I thought I would just add that in since we're speaking on this topic. This is the true origins of the all-seeing eye symbolism, or the one-eye symbolism, and story. One place that we can find this story is in the Norse mythology with Odin and his one eye throughout his story. Now, Norse mythology is very interesting because it is a very robust culture, and this is why most of their mythos stands firm today, and they preserve a lot of the stellar mythology. So it's very important to study Norse mythology. I'm not as well versed as I should be on Norse mythology, but I am getting more into that. But it does tie up into what we're talking about here, especially when it comes to things like Thor's gavel, or his hammer, which is the gavel of Ursa Minor. But some people do associate that to Ursa Major when he's swinging it around, and Ursa Major becomes the tool of the one great architect. So they consider in Norse mythology that Thor's hammer is Ursa Major when it is spinning. So think of the Marvel character Thor when he spins his hammer, and think of Thor as the one great architect. And so I do see relevance in that symbolism as well. So we're going to move on to the next slide, and I hope that I clarified the origins of the all-seeing eye at a decent level for people who don't understand that. So where do we see the all-seeing eye? Well, we see it all over the place. We see it in media. We see it in Freemasonry. We see it in religion. We see it all over the place, right? And yeah, it's true that not every time you see the all-seeing eye, it's being used subversively. You know, we have it so popularized now that just because you have an all-seeing eye on doesn't mean that you're immediately part of the Illuminati. I have an all-seeing eye in my backyard, and, you know, it's a stone pyramid with the all-seeing eye on the top, and I'm not part of the Illuminati, but I do consider all of us to be truly the real Illuminati. But when I speak on that level, in that context, I mean the dark Illuminati. I'm not part of the dark illuminated ones, right? So one of the main places that you can see the subversive use of the all-seeing eye is in Hollywood and in music. You see so many actors and actresses using the symbol of the one eye all over the place. And if you look at the slide that I have provided, you'll see plenty of examples of specifically females in these examples using the one eye symbolism, usually where they're blocking out one of their eyes and, you can only see the other, or even they're blocking it out with some form of creature, or something is obscuring one eye. And in one image here, you have one lady who, it looks like Lady Gaga. I believe that's Lady Gaga. She has half of her face is mechanical, and the other half of her face is human. And I think that this definitely represents the one eye symbolism in that context as well. So, you know, just look around. You'll find the one eye everywhere in this world. There is no place that you will not find the one eye symbolism.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely prevalent for sure. And, you know, it's all to, especially to rile up the conspiracy theorists and to make them look crazy. I know it's definitely used for that reason as well. And, but the thing is, most people don't even know what it really means. They just know that, you know, it seems like it's associated with evil, which, you know, it is in a lot of ways, but people don't know how to explain it because they haven't done enough work to understand where it comes from. And were you going to say anything else about the eye?
No, I just wanted to I was going to move forward into the fasciae symbolism, and then that would be it. Well, and then you could take it from there.
Well, the other eye, you know, the other part of understanding the eye is understanding the all-seeing eye, which is the circled dot, and understanding that the circled dot, the dot within the circle, is, I like to look at it as it is the symbol of alchemy in its truest form, because that's what it's about. It's about becoming raised into the all-seeing eye to be aligned with the all-seeing eye. You know, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to bring light to our eye, which corresponds to the all-seeing eye. It doesn't mean you have the mind of God or anything like that, but, you know, understanding that in the stellar mythos they venerated Horus in that circled dot, and then as it came down into the solar mythos, eventually circled dot ended up becoming the sun. It represented the sun. And it, you know, obviously when you understand alchemy, you understand that both of those are equally as important, because the sun equals light, and then to have light, to raise into light, is to be aligned with the Most High, which is the, from the stellar mythos, it is the circle dot, which is Polaris, and the encompassing circle, which is the feminine, and then the dot in the middle, which is masculine, so that you have the electromagnetism at the molecular level as well. And when you see how that's subverted, you see, you know, it is a target. And, you know, like if you go to the store Target, it's targeting the all-seeing eye, the eye, the third eye, or the eye of the all. And obviously, as Brandon pointed out with Walmart, you have, you know, these stores that are subverting the source. You have Walmart subverting the gavel as the source, and you have Target targeting your mind with the subversive source. So it's very, very, very interesting to see how that symbol comes down, how it's evolved, and what we should be using it for, which is alchemy, and then understanding how it's being used on those who don't understand, because, you know, it clearly is the target, and it is the bull's eye. So, which Brandon broke down the bull symbolism in the other episode very well. So it's all tied together, and I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, that's very important to make clear as well, the circle dot. I'm glad that you brought that up. I actually have a slide that we can provide as well that I have made about the circle dot. And I'll go ahead and throw that in this collection for people. Yeah.
I mean, that symbol is so powerful in the sense that it can reveal so much about ourselves and our history. So, you know, that's a topic that we could, you know, do a whole few shows on.
No doubt with that. No doubts there. Okay, so I'm going to move on here to the next and final symbol here. So if you continue along with us, we're moving through these slides progressively, and the next slide is the fasci symbol, which is a satellite of bundled sticks wrapped around a single pole with a single-headed axe. And this has been used throughout history to represent dominion, you know, control over a dominion, to represent the binding principle of authority over man. So it represents combined power, you know, to unify power and to control something. It represents man's authority. It also represents slavery, materialism, left brain imbalance, and primacy in the north or day sky. So I was speaking about the single-headed axe earlier. So this is a really good example of the single-headed axe and how it gets brought down into the solar mythology and how it gets perverted and used for the ideas of man's authority. And we find this symbol all over the place. We find it on our currency. We can see on the next slide, we find the single-headed axe, the fasci symbol, on the currency of a dime, the United States dime. We find it in Nazi Germany. This is where most people find this symbol. So if you look at the top left symbol, you can see Hitler, and you can see the fasci symbol on the left side of that image. We find it in the courtrooms. We find it in all kinds of judicial buildings. And we find it also, let's say, the Lincoln Monument. If you look on either side of the pillars that Lincoln is sitting in of his throne, there's two pillars, left and right, and you can see the satellite symbols with the binding around all of those sticks. So it's a bundle of sticks that is all wrapped together, and this has to do with amplified power because it's more sticks wrapped together. It's more things put together, more satellite states all bound together to make one centralized authority. So this represents centralized authority over this dominion. So this is one of the most subversive symbols that we have of the single-headed axe. And I mean, I found this symbol in monuments in, you know, places like Cincinnati, and, you know, where there was this general handing the there's this giant statue in the Cincinnati park, and he's handing over the symbol of the fasci to the people. He's, you know, he's handing it down, and it's really interesting, the symbolic nature of that. So just keep your eyes out, especially for the symbol. But let's break down the green language of this word, you know, fasci. So fasci is really interesting. I did a lot of studying on fasci in the past, and I have this book. It's called Demonology, the Encyclopedia of Demonology. And when you look up the word fasci, it tells you to look up the word fascination. So it's very interesting that fascination is spelled very similar to fasci. We have the same phonetic pronunciation that's going into that. So it's the fasci nation, obviously. So you have fascination, which is the fasci nation, or a fascist nation, you know, because most people are fascinated with everything in the world. They're being bound and centralized with their mindset to only focus on politics, to only focus on all the fear mongering coming from the media, to focus on the false propaganda entertainment industry, you know, where they're being mind controlled. And so this is really interesting when you do look this word up. And whenever you look up the word fascination, in this demonology encyclopedia, it tells you to look up the word the evil eye, which I found very interesting. So the evil eye gets associated with the double-headed horns, the symbol that a lot of metalheads use, or the horns of Baphomet as well. So there is a direct association to the fasci and the evil eye, the dark eye, the Illuminati's eye is what I would call it. That is, you know, the eye that's controlling this world. So that ties in with that all-seeing eye symbolism. I just thought I'd add that in there. But yeah, I mean, this symbol is extremely powerful. And, you know, do you have anything you want to add onto that, Nate?
I think that it definitely is a symbol that, you know, I find myself to be a little ignorant to still. But, you know, I try to look at symbols dualistically. And, you know, I look at it as... It could also be a symbol of the middle chamber, which, you know, something we're going to get into on the show in future shows. And, you know, I look at it as a spiritual weapon, and it's like a staircase. And I think that, you know, when you see, you know, single-headed axe, you know, we can say that this is a imbalance, and we can also say that it is possibly a way that we, you know, fight back when we are being oppressed or under duress. And I think it is symbolic of that, but, you know, has it been subversively used? Sure. And, you know, I think it's definitely a study that I'm definitely going to be looking further into, but it is very, very important that we look at these symbols dualistically for sure, because if we don't, then we're not going to reveal the full picture. We're only going to reveal half the picture. And, you know, that's something we're also going to go further into. Trying to understand these symbols. So, yeah, I mean, you know, single-headed axe is very important to pay close attention to when regarding the solar cult, for sure. So,
absolutely. That's why I gave the caveat that none of these are unidirectional, and that they are all, you know, they both have positive and negative uses. So the example I was specifically giving here is the subversive use of the symbol and how it is being used by man's authority and man's dictatorship to reign control over other men. There is some circle dot symbolism in the fasci as well, because you have the circle of the bundle of sticks, and then you have the center pillar, the center stick in the middle that is the dot, you know, which is the center totem. So there's a lot of symbolism within all of these symbols that we can look at. And I find the binding of this is very interesting too, because it could be binding us back to that circle dot, or it could be binding, you know, as in a religious binding as well. So there's positive right. And negative context to all these symbols. They're not just one way or another. So yeah, thank you for pointing that out.
How many sticks is there? Is like 13 sticks in that bundle, or 12 or something?
I think there's 13. I believe there's 13 sticks.
Hmm. Yeah, it's such a interesting symbol for sure. I have a lot of photos of it too. It's definitely on my list of something to study more. So was there anything else that you wanted to add on that, or that you were going to cover?
Nope, that is it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, all this symbolism is really, really important. And we're going to go into what I feel needs to really be understood in order to really make sense of all this. And I think, you know, the best thing that we can do to understand the stellar, the solar, the lunar, and all the other symbols that we've covered so far is, you know, we have to get to the, you know, work at the base. And to work at the base is to understand where all of this really comes from, or what the science is. And we're going to explain something we've touched on in previous shows that's very important and, in my opinion, is extremely misunderstood and overly demonized, even within the so-called truth movement. And this topic is so critical, so crucial to the student that is truly in search for truth itself. And my position is, if we don't understand the science and art of Freemasonry, then we'll most likely be blindly wandering in darkness forever. And I know that sounds insane and crazy, but Brandon and I are hoping to clear some of the confusion up right now regarding this topic, and it's so important. So let's look at the word Freemasonry. We have the word free and masonry. So first, what's the difference between a mason and masonry? Among many derivations, mason simply means builder, so a person who builds. And masons build together, so minds build together who are principled and are morally aligned to natural law, because a mason is one who builds and co-creates reality with others. So, in that sense, anyone who is co-creating a moral society is truly a mason in the truest nature of the word. So, a builder, not a destroyer. This is about understanding the first hermetic principle of mentalism. There are many organizations and orders which form portions of the widespread fraternity of Freemasonry, each having its own structure and terminology. And collectively, these may be referred to as Masonic lodges, Masonic temples, Masonic orders, and rites such as the Scottish or York Rite. And as far as I know, each Masonic lodge confers or grants its Masonic initiates the first three Masonic degrees, which is Entered Apprentice, Fellow Craft, and Master Mason. And degree meaning lower to higher condition of knowledge. And Entered Apprentice, the Fellowship, and Master Mason are symbolically representative of consciousness, meaning thought, emotion, and action. And I wanted to add that looking back through history into the modern day, much of the lodge systems around the world have been highly corrupted and bereft of spiritual wealth. And that's, you know, that's what much of this subversive use of sacred symbolism is all about. The solar, the lunar, the stellar, the eye, and pyramid. You know, it's all Freemasonic symbolism that's been subverted by dark occult sorcerers or the elite, or, you know, the dark hierarchy, for the purpose of what? Of control. So, Mason simply means builder. Now, the word masonry is of two kinds of meanings, which is operative and speculative masonry. Operative masonry is an art, and of course, it is Freemasonry. It's about being engaged in the application of the rules and principles of architecture in the construction of buildings for private and public use. It's for homes of masons and temples or lodges for the worship of deity. This art has been the foundation on which has been built the speculative science of Freemasonry for hundreds of thousands of years. So then you ask yourself, who were the pyramid builders? The lectures of the symbolic degrees instruct the beginner to the difference between the operative and the speculative divisions of masonry. They tell him that, quote, "We work in speculative masonry, but our ancient brethren ornamented in both operative and speculative," unquote. The distinction between operative art and a speculative science is therefore familiar to all Masons from their early instructions. To the Freemason, operative art has been symbolized in that intellectual deduction from which it has been correctly called speculative masonry. And speculative masonry is also another name for Freemasonry, and its modern acceptance may be briefly defined as the scientific application and the religious consecration of the rules and principles, the language, the implements, and materials of operative masonry to the veneration of the Creator, the purification of the heart, and the teaching of the dogmas of religious philosophy. Speculative masonry, or Freemasonry, is a system of morality, and must therefore, like all other ethical systems, have its distinctive doctrines. These may be divided into three classes, which are the moral, the religious, meaning, you know, religion in the sense of binding to truth and natural law, and then the philosophical. And therefore, its definition is one that declares it to be a science of morality. And morality is said to be symbolically one of the precious jewels of a master mason. And let's not forget about the word free, which means not under the control of or in the power over another. So basically, able to act or be done as one wishes while aligned in natural law. So meaning not bound, not in captivity. It is supposedly a rule of Freemasonry that no one can be initiated who is at the time restrained of his liberty. And logically, that makes sense. Otherwise, there's no free in Freemason. Okay, so looking at this slide with the words Freemason and Freemasonry, a lot of people get the words Freemason and Freemasonry confused way too often. First, as I've said, Freemason is a builder, a builder of spiritual stone or physical stone or both, whether within a lodge institution or not. And Freemasonry is the craft. It's the science, the art, the allegories, the symbols. Freemasonry itself is not, it's not people. It's not Freemasons, which are people, nor is Freemasonry good or evil. And Freemasons are not limited to lodges only. Also, it's important to note the behavior of an individual Mason is what can generate good or evil in the world. So it's about behavior of each individual. So Freemasonry is a discoverable symbolic science within nature, the science which is engaged in the investigation of the meaning of symbols and application of their interpretations to moral, religious, and philosophical instruction. In this sense, Freemasonry is essentially a science of symbolism. It is the science that gives humans the potential to evolve into his or her higher type. Freemasonry helps man understand and align with the immutable cosmic laws within creation so that he or she knows how to find inner peace and live harmoniously with nature. Freemasonry is the tool of reflection and transcendence of dogma. Simply, it is the moral science to not do to others what you would not have done to you. So like the golden rule. And in short, Freemasonry is a system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. To ignore and throw this spiritual science out because of the corruption of some Freemasons, so the people, then this becomes one of man's biggest mistakes in his or her journey to discover truth, which is definitely going on all over the world. And, you know, it's by design. We're made to act that way and behave that way.
I think you hit the nail right on the head with Freemasonry, Nathan. That is a very, very simplistic and very easy to understand explanation of what Freemasonry is. Hold on a second. My dogs are going nuts.
Okay, guys, this episode is at its end. Hope you've found clarity and value in this show today, and you can find more shows, presentations, and news at cubbyhole.com. That's CubbyWhole.com. Plus, Douglas Martin's, Brandon's, and my work is now up on OneGreatWorkNetwork.com. It's really awesome. Also, please make sure to keep your eyes out for the next show, as Brandon and I will be going further into the methods of manipulation, and possibly we will have another guest on as well. And as for now, a new show comes out every Friday at 12 p.m. Pacific time, so stay tuned for more. And if you have any questions regarding the topics for these shows or the Seed for Growth event, please email us at cubbyhole@mail.com. That's cubbyhole@mail.com. Also, any donations are appreciated, as anything that's given will go directly to the Cubbyhole website. Just hit the donation button on the website and it's set up pretty easy to operate from there. So, okay, guys. I'm your host, Nate Kapp. Thank you for listening. And remember, do no harm, defend truth, and keep transcending dogma.